Okay, it is October 20th, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. Jamie Dimon from JPMorgan Chase. Mr. Dimon, my name is Chris Seifer, and with me here is Greg Felberg and Landon Strobor with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. As you know from testifying at our first hearing, we were set up by a statute last year to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis. I'll leave it at that and not go through anything else. So let's just jump right into it. As we discussed a little before we threw on the tape, you know, the first thing we'd like to ask you about is sort of the high-level question about what you believe the primary causes of the financial crisis were. As I said earlier, we have re-reviewed your written statement from the January hearing, and of course know about that, but we'd like to get for the record what you believe the primary causes were, please.
Okay, and I think, thank you, and I think it's important, by the way, I'm going to give you maybe five or ten,
sure.
But it's the confluence of those that caused it. I think that any one of those on a standalone basis might not have caused the crisis, and I think it's important that policymakers understand that while we need to fix all these things, you know, they should be looking for a silver bullet that was the one cause. And the biggest and at the heart of the thing, I think, is mortgages and mortgage underwriting. Over many, many years, underwriting standards have changed, and there was a higher loan-to-value, less and less income verification. And, you know, unfortunately, that all seemed to work. As home prices are going up, there are no losses. But more and more leverage, no losses, led to higher home prices. And eventually, when home prices start to reverse, people start to have losses, and you can see that high LTV, not verifying income, were not a good idea. And so we've gone back to standards. Those mortgages ended up in balance sheet banks, they ended up in securitizations. The worst ones were done by mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers. I think the banks who actually underwrote them did a better job than most, but not that they were perfect. They ended up in CMOs, they ended up with the GSEs, they ended up in AIG's credit derivatives. But at the heart of it was just this terrible mortgage underwriting. And I would probably submit to you, if you look at a lot of crises, real estate has been one of the primary things, and which is why we support proper regulation around it. I think the regulation around mortgages was unfortunate because it was basically unregulated at certain levels. There was a kind of caused the rates to the bottom. And so you're going to lose business if you don't cut your fees and get more aggressive on underwriting. And I think it, having good regulation would help that. I think there's too much leverage in the system generally. You mentioned repos, but that was one area. Hedge funds were levered. You know, even pension plans and universities are leveraged up by making future commitments, which is a form of leverage. Okay, the investment banks had adopted Basel III in the United States, which allowed them more leverage. Basel III allowed a lot more leverage in European banks. So I would say leverage. There was leverage everywhere, and so it wasn't just one place. Basel II. I'm sorry. And the securitization market I've already mentioned, but it was really how they were written. I do think there are legitimate complaints about the responsibility along the chain of mortgages and securitizations. I think leverage lending a little bit. I wouldn't blame it on that, but I think I'd put that in the category as it just kind of had created more leverage in the system. I think one of the root causes underlying all this, by the way, was the United States running with 1% interest rates and running a $500 million trade deficit for 4, 5, or 6 years. I think was the epitome of irresponsibility. I think you got to really talk to the economists about it, but that did lead, in my opinion, I do believe this to. You know, we were putting dollars overseas. The dollars had to be reinvested. They got reinvested in treasuries and mortgages to lower and lower rates, which leads to more and more speculation and bubbles here. And so I think that caused a problem. I do think there was more interconnectedness in the system than people had realized. People always knew it was there. It's always been there, but I think it was a little more. I don't think derivatives caused the problem, but I think the AIG derivatives, they were in a life company, they were counted for as life insurance contracts, they were one-sided, whereas most of us run hedge books, the AIG contracts were one-sided, so if you're wrong, it causes a problem, and so I think derivatives in their own way helped transmit this issue, didn't create the issue. I'm sure there are others that I can't remember offhand.
Okay, so let me ask you a little bit about the biggest cause, the mortgages and the underwriting, high LTVs, reduced documentation requirements. Why do you think that came to be?
Oh, I should also mention Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which I personally were the biggest disasters of all time. And that one was an accident waiting to happen. We all knew about it. We all worried about it. No one did anything about it. And they also participated in creating more and more mortgage products, and Alt-A and subprime and stuff like that. And but your question about mortgage was, why did it come to be?
Yeah, why the decline in underwriting standards?
You know, I think if you look at it, if you made a chart over a 20-year period of LTV, that people were willing to lend more and more money, but they weren't having losses, you know, so you kind of got sucked in this false sense of security because there were no losses. And then stated income, you know, you can get a lot of information on people, so people use FICO scores and stuff like that. So, you know, in the old days, you had to show me a tax return or a pay stub, but with the FICO score and knowing your address and a bunch of other stuff, you can come pretty close to income verification, so it was just easier. The markets were more accommodating, so it just got laxer and laxer over time, and there were no losses. And so, you know, we have to write a letter to the next generation to tell them 80% loan to value. I think the general thought was is that people were good credits, and you had the mortgage. You had a belt and suspenders, even if you had 100% loan to value. And remember, I'm not always against 100% loan to value. There are reasons. In a lot of small businesses, that's how they get their money. They borrow a home equity loan, and they have a little bit of collateral, and they use the collateral of their home. And so you don't want to kill all of that. You just want to be very careful how it's done. And
so one of the things we've heard from some other folks we've talked to, particularly mortgage bankers that we've talked to, have pretty much said their underwriting standards were simply driven by what they could sell into the secondary market, whether it was Fannie and Freddie or whether it was the street. And many of them have told us that, you know, at least in the mid-2000s, it was really the street that they were underwriting to, and that's where all of the subprime and the Alt-A and the low-doc, no-doc, and the pay option ARM loans were going. You have any opinions?
No. Yeah, no, it's completely untrue. There's some truth to it, okay? So option ARMs, which I think were the worst product, were done by OTS banks, Office of the Thrift Banks, and put in the balance sheets of those banks. They weren't even commercial banks. So I think WaMu and Golden West, which was bought by Wachovia, that's where the bulk of it. Remember, I'm not aware of option arms being put in securitizations at all. Okay, I do think in certain of those standards that they were being put in securitizations, so they're meeting the standards of not, and you say Wall Street, you've got to be very careful, they're meeting the standards of the investor, okay, and Wall Street. And a lot of investors there. And I also want to separate, by the way, where we loosened, there were loosened underwriting standards, so like going to 100% LTV, there was also where I would say people lied.
Right.
Or they didn't do things right. There was more and more of that in the frothy market, too. And obviously that's not legitimate. That's people are stretching to get things done that they should have been stretching at the origination level. I don't think a lot of banks would have deliberately been taking stuff they know was improperly underwritten and been sold it.
Okay. What about in the decade of the 2000s, we saw a pretty big increase in the growth of the structured credit products market. Do you see that having any, you know, cause and effect relationship with the growth in one secure? Go ahead.
I would add that to the list of issues, but again, I don't think it caused it. It just was another repository of assets in there. And CDOs and some of these structured products are actually perfectly legitimate ways to run money. They're being done today, CLOs and CDOs. It's just a way of tranching risk and managing risk. But it did, you know, I have to confess that, you know, CDO squares, you know, you got to question. When it all became subprime CDOs, you have to question, you know, the issue there. I would say that when you say strike, I should have added my list of what caused it. Some of these off-balance sheet things like SIBs, okay, which just created more leverage in the system that was not visible to people. And in reality, the responsibility for those SIBs came back on some of the bank balance sheets. So I would, and they also became repositories for mortgages and other things. And so I think it was another area just added to to the leverage.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, another thing we've been looking at is of course, as we saw the increase in the mortgages, you know, whether they're in the securitizations or whether they're on the bank and investment bank balance sheets, of course, and the investment banks primarily, we're funding a lot of these assets with short-term funds, you know, whether it was commercial paper or repos. And I think what we've seen is certainly over time, you know, in the repo market, you saw, whereas it used to be primarily or exclusively treasuries and agencies, you started to see a lot more asset-backed securities, in particular mortgage-related securities, being financed by the repo market. And since J.P. Morgan is one of the clearing banks, along with Boney, you know, can you sort of give us your views on what was going on with the repo market?
Right, and you raised two issues I should have added to the cause, which is too much short-term financing and too much leverage in some of that short-term financing. Mm-hmm. So and I wrote about this in my chairman's letter, so if you go get that from like 08, I actually listed all of these issues. And even the CIVs created more short-term lending to own long-term assets. So, you know, one of the rules of finance is, you know, don't buy long-term illiquid assets funded short. I mean, it's just a sine qua non, and the CIVs did it, and other people did it. So here's what happened, and you're absolutely correct. In the repo markets, it was really two things. And this is, by, I'm going to say repo in general. This is not, you said, one of the two clearing banks. This is a lot of this is bilateral.
Right.
So the clearing, tri-party stuff, I forgot the number, but I think total tri-party was a trillion. I mean, I don't remember the number offhand. A trillion and a half? Whatever the number is. But the total repo markets were another two. Or two and a half. I think the bilateral repo markets were bigger than the tri-party market. Remember, tri-party is just another form of repo. And but I think it is true that in the markets there was less and less haircuts being taken on the financing. But that's normal in hot markets. And obviously dealers have to be very careful about asking for proper haircuts. Remember, you have belts and suspenders there too. You got the asset, usually a very liquid asset and stuff like that. But I think there was more and more leverage because the market was willing to lend more money against the collateral. And again, remember, that market is not Wall Street. That market is money funds, Wall Street, investors. And you're also correct that collateral became less and less what I call standard. And the problem with that is when people got scared, they wouldn't finance the non-standard stuff at all. So people just lost their financing. Whereas, you know, it was a Treasury or Ginnie Mae, they would finance it, but instead of, you know, asking you to put up 1%, they'd ask for 3%. So it was a slightly different. So I do think that happened. And that happened, that aggressive financing was in all the repo markets, the tri-party markets. And again, remember, there are a lot of people investing in that. So if you look at money funds, and you'll see that was a very widely distributed thing.
So let me ask you a little about that. You know, as I'm sure you know, we talked to your chief risk officer, Mr. Zubro, and he had told us before that I think beginning sometime in 07, you know, he and others were talking to investors about increasing the haircuts and voicing his concerns about the non-treasury and agency collateral. One, and then, but two, we've seen in a lot of documents anyway, and in some other interviews, that folks were surprised when Bear went down that the repo financing went away so quick, since it was secured, whereas it wasn't so much of a surprise that unsecured commercial paper financing would go away. But on the other hand, again, three, the Bear Stearns hedge funds blew up in 07, and the repo financiers took back their collateral, and of course Countrywide had their liquidity crisis in August in the same way. So I guess what I'm asking you to do with those three data points anyway, to sort of comment on, or what the thinking was, you know, in terms of the repo market, even with this non-agency treasury collateral, since it was still secured financing.
Right. So I think, Brian, you made the point already, which is, and this is, I'm not going to say it's not a bear statement, that when people got scared, they pulled back on heavily on the non-standard financing at all. Because, you know, they were making an extra 15 basis points. They say, you know what, I don't want any of that. It's just, I don't want to put it in my report to my investors, whether it's a mutual fund or something like that. And they ask for higher haircuts on the more standard stuff. Though being prepared for that is, people generally try to be prepared for the fact that those standards might change. And so firms hold liquidity to be prepared for that. You know, each firm is different. But you know, there was, I reminded people, I call it, there was like a run on the markets, okay? If you ask investors around the world, what did you do? They all say, well, I got more conservative, of course. But they're the ones who pulled all this financing out. And sometimes, you know, it was perfectly legitimate, collateralized, secure financing. But it was the acts of all these people at once that caused runs in the marketplace. And of course, you saw rolling runs in the marketplace. You know, it would be one institution and another, and people get scared to be another. And of course, when they pulled the financing, they had to start dumping the assets, and you know, it started a whole other confluence of events taking place.
So how did, I mean, since J.P. Morgan was the clearing bank for some of the tri-party repo borrowers, how did J.P. Morgan go about, you know, monitoring its exposure, and how did it go about determining whether or not, you know, how it was being compensated, what was adequate to cover that exposure?
Well, that we know wasn't adequate. But I here's how I put it, okay? The tri-party arrangement, remember, is agent.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do a bilateral, so if Fidelity calls up anyone and says, I want to invest my money fund in a repo, you know, because I want, you know, so much of my money fund short, so much secured, and so much secured by treasuries, and you get paid a little bit more if it's secured by Ginnie Mae's, and paid a little bit more if it's secured by CMO, and paid a little bit more if it's short-term secured. That means that every day, a lot of these things are very short, but not all one day, but that every day they're moving money back and forth, moving collateral back and forth, and it costs, I forgot how much, you know, it costs $10 or something just to move collateral from my account to your account, and someone invented the thing saying, just leave the collateral in the custody bank, leave the collateral with someone, and just roll it over every day. So it was the ease. It was still Fidelity rolling over collateral owned by somebody else and getting paid for it. They negotiated the fee, so we just charged a fee for the service, but they negotiated the fee, they approved the underwriting, they approved the haircut. I think over time it got just lax like everything else in the repo market. That's all. There's no other mystery about tri-party. And the only other thing I add is the intraday exposure. And I think this we did know about, that people were aware of, that, and the two big banks and the Fed had conversations about making sure that intraday exposure is covered a little bit. And which I think this is a perfectly reasonable, natural thing. And most of the firms are doing it slowly so the customers could get adjusted to it. And all I was asking is that whatever haircut you had, in this essence, whatever haircut you had with all the clients overnight, you kept with the firm during the day. The extra haircut, that's all, mm-hmm. which I think is a perfectly reasonable and normal thing to do.
So I guess the
world started to focus all this repo stuff, there's also focus on tri-party for exactly the same reason.
So did J.P. Morgan have any kind of plan or contingency plan if a dealer that you guys were providing the intraday funding to defaulted intraday?
Yeah, if they defaulted intraday, we own the securities.
Right.
And we have to liquidate them. That's a huge risk to us. And in fact, that's what happened, okay, with Lehman. And if you had a little haircut, you're protected. Now, it's not good for the system. You know, we protected the system by not dumping it all in one day. I mean, so you guys, there's pluses and minuses, but you know, one of the risks is that somehow someone so big went down that there's too much being dumped on the market all at once, and so that's, the intraday was the protection for that, and also knowing the assets, being able to manage the assets. I mean, I think having a trade, you know, having people actually know what they're doing with that is very different if you didn't, because you know, how would you sell those assets if you didn't have people who knew how to buy and how to sell them? And So what was expected, how it was financed, what the haircut was, all were all ways of protecting yourself.
Right. So understanding that providing the intraday funding and having the risk of taking that collateral if there was an intraday default, one, you guys had the haircuts, two, you knew what the collateral was. But what was the plan if God forbid, that actually happened? I mean, would J.P. Morgan simply try to dispose of the collateral, or what would it do?
Yeah, that we would immediately hedge or dispose of the collateral in the way that we thought caused us the least damage. We would have a claim back on the bankrupt company,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that it was. But, you know, I wouldn't personally expect to collect anything when something happens like that. And that's exactly what happened with Lehman. We ended up with the collateral. And thank God we had enough haircuts eventually to handle most of the liquidation and stuff like that. And, you know, if you say, could J.P. Morgan handle $50 billion of various types of collateral that we know, well, yeah. You know, and I would tell you, okay, I would tell my board that we can lose, you know, a couple hundred million, depending on what the collateral is, selling it. And I would just blow it right out. I wouldn't sit there and wait. We're big boys. We'd take the risk and move on. We'd try to eliminate the risk and move on.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you guys acquired Bear in March of 2008, at the same time the Fed announced the primary dealer credit facility, which was a backup for the dealers, at least in terms of the overnight financing for the repos. Did that, in your mind, provide any additional protection for you guys providing the intraday funding?
No. No, because we wouldn't have used that anyway, and that was just on what we call Fed eligible stuff, which I would say is the easier stuff to handle.
Right. Did it provide any type of additional comfort for, you know, unwinding the repos at the beginning of the following day?
No.
Okay.
It didn't. I mean, wouldn't have been material enough to us. I think it may have been material to some of the other investment banks.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like I said, it would handle the stuff that they, for the most part, had no problem handling. Remember the Fed window, or whatever it's called, the PDCF. The haircuts, you could probably still get better haircuts in the market. So I don't remember going through the exercise. I just don't offhand think it would have been a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall, did you have any discussions with any of the folks in the government about the PDCF being set up before it was actually announced?
I don't recall. And when on that particular night, believe me, it was not my concern.
Right. I
do remember someone in the government telling me that we shouldn't worry about Bear Stearns because you know, once it gets saved and the Fed's taking action, that the markets will go up. I said, oh yeah? I said, that's how much you know about markets, because when you just told the world that a major investment bank had a major problem, you know, it isn't necessarily a good piece of news. Because they didn't know that was the case, really.
Right. Can you just walk us through Bear Weekend so we have your recollection of how it went down?
I try to repress most of it.
I'm sure.
I was sitting, for the we who heard, you know, we were a clearing bank and a trading house, so we knew our bear exposures. But until I got the phone call on Thursday night, I was at a restaurant, and I was like, I'm going to say it was 8:30, and Alan Schwartz got on the phone and literally said something like, Jamie, we're having a real problem. You know, we're losing liquidity. We need to borrow $30 billion. Can you lend us $30 billion tonight? Which I said, Alan, we can't lend $30 billion tonight. I mean, I have a responsibility and a board. And I asked him to talk to the Fed and the Treasury. He said he had. I immediately got on the phone call with Tim Geithner here, Ben Bernanke, Hank Paulson, because this was a calamity, you know, and they needed the money before the markets would open. Everyone worked around the clock, and we refused to do it, even though they were asking us to do it. I said, we'll do it, but you have to backstop it. So we came up with this thing where the Fed was going to was backstopping a loan that J.P. Morgan was making. So we announced the next morning that we're making a $30 billion loan, $28 billion or some number, $30 billion loan, secured loan to Bear Stearns, and that we'd be working around the weekend. We didn't make the announcement, we'd be working on the weekend to do something. I knew, by the way, that it was just very short term. I thought this will keep them alive till the weekend, and.
What was the plan Thursday and Friday at that point? Were you considering acquiring the company?
So what I think the plan on Thursday and Friday was that Bear Stearns was going to be looking for its own liquidity and stuff like that, and all its options. And they had options. You know, I know they were talking to people and stuff like that, and that we had agreed that we'd look at it to see if it was possible and or feasible for J.P. Morgan to.
Chris, in general, you know, we spoke to you about what he saw when he sort of opened up the curtain or turned in terms of issues that there, if there were. I don't think we spoke about sort of the what happened the weekend, so we haven't spoken to Jamie about it, but so keep it general, please.
Sure. Well, why don't you generally take us through the rest of the weekend and then let us know what you found in the trunk at the end of the weekend and following.
So we, buying a company is a massive endeavor, okay? And, you know, fortunately, we had, I'm going to say, 1,000 people around the world come in and, you know, set up work teams to look at, I think it was doing due diligence in a three-day period. And then we did it desk by desk and system by system and litigation by litigation about all the issues. And eventually told the Fed that we could buy the company, but they're going to have to take $30 billion of their real estate. And I do remind people, they took the better real estate, not the worst real estate, because the Fed had a requirement that had to do investment, U.S. dollar investment grade. They couldn't do other stuff. And for us, it wasn't a question of that. I thought anything less about that for those two assets. It was simply a bridge too far to borrow another $30 billion, have that kind of leverage, and to that we would have to liquidate, by the way, to manage our own risk positions, and to have more real estate. And I told them that, you know, we can't be put in a position that the day after doing this, people, you know, we're a teetering giant. You know, at the end of the day, the Fed agreed to do that. We announced the acquisition on Monday, and to me, and then over the next week, we renegotiated parts of which I, you know, to me, the price wasn't significant, but we had to protect ourselves. We had enormous things, and these are all in the analyst presentation I made, about what we really had to worry about to protect ourselves. I called it a margin for error. Number one, obviously, since a company would be sued left and right, and that, you know, we couldn't walk away from that, which I think is a ridiculous outcome, by the way, that the United States has to do something and then we get sued, but we had to put up money to protect us from that. We had the cost of integration, which are, you know, the huge systems integration, and obviously laying off people and consolidating the company. And I think the biggest cost to us and the biggest fear, I'm going to call it de-risking. Okay? And so we were buying a balance sheet of $250 billion, something like that. We could not, $300 billion, we could not afford to just sit there with it. So we had to hedge it, liquidate it, and a lot, and remember, some of it duplicated positions we already had. And, you know, it was a risk matter. You know, I always say, look, you can have so much of X, but not twice that. So to protect yourself. So we knew that we had to do something, that Bear Stearns on an ongoing basis wouldn't have necessarily had to do, which is sell a lot of assets very quickly. And we were prepared to take a lot of losses while doing that. So, and I knew that we're going to doing it more likely than not in very difficult markets, which is what they were. And
understanding that the government took $30 billion or ring fenced out $30 billion of the investment grade real estate assets anyway. Did you guys find, you know, what was your opinion of the valuations of the assets that Bear had when you took over the company?
Yeah, so, you know, listen, trader, when you get to certain products, you know, you always have trader differences, and, you know, we might have marked things differently than them, but I wouldn't say that was the major issue for us. The major issue for us is we had to sell a lot of it. So if you had a position of, and I'll give you one example, of $1 billion of Chrysler, which they had, mm-hmm. Okay? We had already had $1 billion of Chrysler, I forgot the exact number. Well, you know, you might have Chrysler marked at 60 cents in the dollar, which I think what they had it marked at. But if you were trying to move $1 billion, you're going to have to sell it at 45 or 50 mm-hmm. in that market. So we prepared to sell it for 45 or 50. So we put up money to get rid of stuff very quickly. And so there may have been disagreements that people have had, but I'm not sure you would have found that many differences around the street on how some of those things were marked. I didn't go through every position myself. I had our people reviewed book after book to make sure it was adequate and fair. And to remind you and to be fair to them, there were certain things on the books that were also worth more, mm-hmm. like their building, which we knew about, and other stuff. So, but again, a liquid.
Right, right. A non-mark-to-market type asset.
Right.
So then, following Bear, going back to the repo subject, did J.P. Morgan change the way it was managing intraday exposures, given what happened with Bear?
I think we had been changing it during the whole time period, which is getting, we're spending more time to understand the real collateral, making sure the investors understood the real collateral, making sure the pricing was accurate, because various pricing things are used for, talking to the clients about putting up over time intraday margin, and just trying to make sure it's a far better managed process and doesn't create either systemic risk or risk to J.P. Morgan. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that had already been taking place, and it continued taking place right through the process.
So what started? I'm sorry, this is Greg Feldberg. What started that that process? Was it the summer and the disruption in the repo market earlier in 2007?
I think it started. I vaguely remember starting earlier. Yes.
I mean, can we attribute this to Countrywide's failure over repo financing?
I think was Countrywide using Tri-Party or doing bilateral? I don't know exactly. I mean, I know Countrywide, they were clients like that, but I don't know exactly what happened. Again, I wouldn't say with the failure of this repo. I think there were other issues involved in why people got scared, and I don't know what their collateral was. So,
okay. I mean, one of the things.
I don't think the tightening up of. And you look at repo in general. It's not the tri-party. If the investor says, I want a 2% haircut as opposed to 1, that's not the tri-party agent. That's the repo market. The repo markets were going to get tougher. And they were getting tougher, and they were tightening up. They started tightening up before Bear, and I don't remember. I mean, you can actually get real information to find out that they probably continued to tighten up right to Lehman. And then after that, some of it just disappeared.
One other thing we've heard from some other folks we've talked to is that, you know, going way back before 2007, you know, the mortgage-related securities and, you know, were becoming more and more prevalent and more accepted as an instrument and traded by more and more folks, and so it became more accepted as an instrument that would be financed through the repo market, whether bilateral or tri-party. But then, of course, you know, home prices start to flatten and then decline in 06 and 07, and delinquencies start to go up, and people are getting a little squirrely on the value of the assets, particularly the structured assets that are less transparent, and they become more liquid with less price discovery. And that, you know, they said was the reason that both overnight repo investors and the clearing bank started to, you know, look closer and require larger haircuts and perhaps even at some point saying we don't even want to be in this anymore given the marginal increase in yield that they were getting. Is that consistent with your understanding? Is that wrong? Or?
So that's generally accurate, but the only difference is, remember, standard MBS, Ginnie Mae, that had always been in the repo markets. And even, you know, if you go back to Kidder Peabody in 1987, people were repoing. You know, you remember IOS and Jump Z bonds and, you know, all that? So it wasn't like it never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
And then when people get scared of certain things, they stop financing them. That's not atypical. And it happened in other securities before. It wasn't just repo markets that some of it was happening. But yes, I think over time, the people getting more conscious and providing less credit and being tougher on what they would finance at all.
And were you generally, was J.P. Morgan seeing post-Bear the overnight repo investors either requiring larger haircuts or just pulling away from the market in general?
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember the specifics, but in general, yes.
So some folks have
characterized... You would if you were Fidelity, too. You'd be saying, you know what? I'm not going to finance this anymore
Some folks have told us that that there was an unwillingness to lend and repo even on treasuries, and the concern really became more the counterparty than the collateral. Does that sound right?
Look, you're talking about a marketplace now. There are some people who said, I will not deal with that counterparty at all, regardless of the collateral. That's true. That was not true for everybody, though. I think a lot of people had no problem financing the treasuries throughout this whole crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I think that some people say, I'm not going to deal with that company, and others didn't. But I don't think it was a blanket kind of thing around treasuries. You know, but I understand that. I've seen that before where, you know, board of directors says, I don't care if you have, you know, if you have gold as collateral, I don't want to see, you know, Countrywide on my investment list. Because that's how it shows up. Countrywide repo, you know, or, and that's what happens. People just say those things and they won't do it anymore. But not that, I'm sure people are doing Countrywide treasuries right to the end.
So you said that you had previously had conversations with the Fed, and I guess we're also interested. I mean, when did those conversations start? Did they date back earlier, or was that also kind of starting in 07?
About Tri-Party?
Yeah.
I honestly don't remember if it was before or after Bear, but look, if I was the Fed, I would have been looking at that, too. I mean, that's a reasonable concern they should have. Now you're focusing an awful lot on Tri-Party, but I should have added to my list of what caused the problem. There was a run on the money markets. The mutual money funds broke the buck. Now, you may not know this, but money funds have broken the buck before. I'm going to say, if I remember correctly, 60 times. On 58 of them, someone fixed it.
Right.
By the way, you'd ask the question, too, what's the big deal? Okay, so one day you get your money fund and it says it's not worth par, it's worth 99. The big deal is it caused a run on the funds. And those funds couldn't liquidate those securities. And by the way, that's still an issue. So, like, the SEC has made money funds more conservative, but they could still have this issue, and the only thing they could do is dump assets and on the marketplace. And so, like, even, you know, I wouldn't blame hedge funds for the crisis, but they also reduced their leverage by $1 trillion or something in the middle of the crisis. Money funds did. Commercial paper couldn't be financed. You know, AAA companies couldn't roll over their commercial paper. Money funds couldn't get the liquidity they needed. So, you know, the repo market is just a teeny part of the money markets in general.
And
we're really under.
And when you talk about these problems, what kind of timing are you talking about?
I think, they really blew up when Lehman, you know, with
right.
Lehman.
Right, and
that's where.
Right, that's when the reserve primary fund broke the buck, and that's when a lot of others would have if they didn't get bailed out. I mean, but were you seeing that, you know, pre-Lehman bankruptcy?
Well, yeah, I think you guys all mentioned it, whereas some people were backing out of this market, some were backing out of that market. The markets were, like, fickle and nervous and right before Lehman, you know, for the month before Lehman. It wasn't just Lehman. Mm-hmm. Lehman was just kind of that hole in the dike just burst.
So can you, again, generally walk us through Lehman Weekend now? Of course, we know a lot, and we've talked to a lot of people and read most, if not all, the books. But we still want to get folks' accounts of what was happening that week and what their role was. So we know, for example, that, you know, people get the calls, you know, late Friday afternoon to come in and Paulson and Geithner make the presentation. But can you just walk us through what your role was on through the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday?
Yeah, well, like I said, in reality, there was no role at all except going down there and listening to all this stuff. But we got the call to go down. It was Friday night. I was extremely bummed out, so I was about to meet my son-in-law at the B's parents for the first time. And we went down and we did the speech, which I'm sure you've heard. And I probably was the only one who left early, so I had to get back to that dinner. What we heard, and, you know, and I'm going to interpret this a little bit, is the government's not going to bail them out. Not everyone believed that. I did, by the way. You guys have to continue to come with an industry solution like we did in long-term capital. So think of it as a way that the industry can come together and fund Lehman or somehow. And third, you got to be prepared if for some reason we don't find a solution. We also knew there were conversations that Lehman was having with, I think most people guessed, Barclays and Bank of America. And so the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, was really having those conversations. You know, can you have a funding facility? In fact, the industry came up with a $70 billion funding facility. Think of it as funding the liquid assets of anyone who got into trouble, because the other concern was, well, it's not just Lehman. You might have other people who have this requirement that lose all funding capability. And And then we heard, you know, at one point that one deal was broken, and at one point that the other deal wasn't going to happen, so that more, I guess on Sunday, it was more getting prepared for the obvious collapse of Lehman.
So were you, I mean, we've also heard, of course, about the three groups that are set up, you know, to you know, one of which was valuing the assets, et cetera. Were you part of one of those three groups?
Yeah, I don't give those three groups great significance, by the way, but I was the group that was looking for the solution to fund, not the asset valuation group. I guess the third one was the holy Christ, what do we do now group.
Right. And understanding you weren't part of either the holy Christ, what do we do now group or the asset valuation group, we've heard from others differing numbers on what the overvaluations apparently were. What do you recall hearing, if anything, about that?
Yeah, and so I'd be very careful of the word overvaluation because, you know, everyone, you know, you get 10 people in the room, you have 10 opinions.
Right.
On a liquid thing. And also, 10 different opinions about what's going to be worth tomorrow as opposed to what it was worth yesterday, particularly when you have a bankruptcy. So, and the number I remember is $20 billion. The whole of Lehman was 20, and I don't know if that was all of it or just the stuff they were looking at or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any conversations with anyone in the government, you know, about whether the government was considering or would provide assistance, regardless of the speech that was given Friday night?
No, I think they were very, but I remember they were very consistent. And if the word assistance was ever used, it was more like what can they do within their authority to help alleviate the situation. Not, they were not going to provide assistance to Lehman. They were not going to take a loss from Lehman, they weren't going to fund Lehman, but they have other tools. So, and I do remember people, you know, that they would try to figure out stuff, but it was like opening up a primary dealer window. We knew they could do other things that could, you know, within their bailiwick that would help. A solution. So if, you know, maybe the industry had come up with a solution to, you know, to save Lehman, they would have made some very aggressive financial moves in the marketplace the next day. But not that they would save Lehman.
So you said other folks in the room didn't believe that, but you did believe that. Why? Can you explain?
Yeah, there's 10 people. You know, we have 20 people. We have 20 opinions. I thought some people. I really don't know. I mean, I think some people thought it was so bad there's no way they'd let it happen. Mm-hmm. But I guess I was also of a different opinion. I didn't think it was so bad. Now, I hate to say that. I don't mean that in a bad way. But I think it was almost the same if on Monday morning the government had saved Lehman. And I just believe this is my own opinion. You still would have had terrible things happen. Okay, in other words, the disaster would have unfolded because AIG was going to have their problems. That had nothing to do with Lehman. And you were still going to have a run of the other banks, and you were still going to have absolute fear and panic in the global markets. And so whether Lehman itself got saved or not, those things were going to happen. So the crisis would have unfolded along a different path, but it probably would have unfolded.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you recall any discussions at the time about a Maiden Lane type structure? I mean, they'd done one with you guys for Bear, and I know they wanted the private consortium to essentially do a private Maiden Lane. But was there any discussion about a Maiden Lane 2, although not a Maiden Lane 2 for AIG, but a Maiden Lane 2 for a potential to ring-fence Lehman's bad assets?
There, I do not recall a comment. I'm sure other people suggested it, but I think they were consistent. They're not going to do something like that.
Did you think Lehman was too big to fail?
No, I just thought that it was not... I mean, you know, when you say too big to fail, no. I mean, I thought the failure of a big company like that was going to have disastrous consequences, or the saving of a big company like that would have disastrous consequences, and I don't think anyone should be too big to fail. I think that we've got to be able to handle all the fallout for failure. Failure itself is not a terrible thing, and remember, there's a huge... You can't separate the cumulative effect of this on the system. So, like AIG... Had everything been happy and healthy, AIG going to bankruptcy would have been okay, I think. But not, it wasn't okay after Bear, after Lehman, after Countrywide, after this. It was the cumulative effect that just became traumatic. And so even Lehman failing, had it happened in a healthy market because they had some terrible flaw that was unrelated to everything else? No, I don't think, I'm not sure it would have been so disastrous as it was after all the things we had gone through. And like I said, the buildup of underlying problems, you know, were there, like the leverage in the system. And
Do you recall ever hearing the government say, or discussions otherwise, that, you know, not that they simply were not going to provide assistance to Lehman, but that they simply didn't have the authority to do so?
Yes.
And can you explain what you heard?
Yeah, they were pretty consistent. We're not going to, and we don't have the authority to.
Did they explain?
I don't remember.
And I'm sorry, did they explain, you know, anything beyond we don't have the authorities, why they didn't have the authorities, what they were talking about?
I guess the first point is, I personally thought that it was not politically feasible. I mean, I thought that Hank Paulson was simply saying a fact. We, government, are not going to stop the bankruptcy of Lehman. I don't think he was playing games. I think it was a political calculation. I think it was a legal calculation. I don't know which one dominated. I don't even know the specific laws about what they could do. I do know that there wasn't a resolution mechanism in place like the FDIC had with WaMu. But there's a law in place that says that this institution of the government, by law, can take over a troubled bank and then do the following things by law. There was nothing to allow them to do that with Lehman. And the Fed had this requirement that whatever they did, it had to be fully collateralized. You know, and I think they tried to stick to that throughout this crisis. I think they could have made the argument they could do it over here, but they could have done it over there because one was fully collateralized and one wasn't.
Did you think that Lehman was solvent at the time?
What does solvent mean?
Positive capital. I mean, you had mentioned earlier that you had heard that the estimates of the assets, understanding 10 people have 10 different opinions, was about $20 billion. I don't have Lehman's Q in front of me, but I think they were reporting before those types of opinions about $26 billion in gap capital. So for the purposes of this conversation anyway, I would say solvent is positive gap capital.
Right. So the answer is I don't know. I still could not answer that question. I wasn't inside Lehman. I never looked at all their books and records, so I really don't know.
Okay. So you mentioned that on Friday AIG was inevitably going to go bankrupt. At what point did you become aware of that situation?
I don't think he said on Friday.
Okay. So we were talking about Friday.
You can ask him what he said.
Okay.
I did not say that on Friday.
Okay.
We knew that AIG had issues, but it was the same thing. I did not know how bad all their issues were. I'm not sure anyone knew until maybe Sunday or Monday, to tell you the truth.
So, I mean, yeah, one of the things we've seen in the documents and in interviews, of course, you know, you and many others are summoned to the New York Fed, you know, late Friday afternoon, early Friday evening to deal with Lehman. We know from documents that AIG, and from interviews, that AIG showed up the same day, you know, saying, "Hey, we need money." But
I don't think that was Friday.
It was Saturday.
I think they showed up on Saturday or Sunday.
Okay, and all I'm getting at is when, if ever, you know, during the weekend, did you find out about AIG and were you involved in any discussions, you know, with the government about a possible resolution of AIG?
Okay, so we knew AIG had issues because we were one of their investment banks. But I would say the same thing. We didn't know the full depth or extent of them. In fact, I don't think AIG knew the full depth or extent until that Saturday when they came in and said, "We have a real problem." Okay, so on Saturday or Sunday, I did meet at one point on AIG with Hank and some others. Dan Jester and some other people in the room. And the reason I remember Dan Jester is because I called him, his name was Chester. and had to apologize to him later. And I think it was a very just general conversation. And Bob Willemstad, who was the current CEO, that they had a huge problem, and that it was soon. That it was not, you know, it wasn't like they have to, you know, put up reserves over an extended period of time, which is more normal in an insurance company. But they needed money, cash, right away. But I, and again, I don't remember that number. That was changing by the minute on that Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And they had already had investment banks in and lots of people. They were trying to do it like kind of piecemeal. I don't think they maybe understood the real depth of the problem until very late.
Before we get to that. So what's your understanding or what did you hear about the reason the Barclays deal fell through?
Only honestly what's been in the public domain. You know, and I, you know, that they wanted to do it and the FSA didn't want to do it, and Hank says it was that they were unwilling to allow that deal to go forward with too much risk for Barclays. The FSA, by the way, has a slightly different story than that. But I don't know the real truth, and I don't care. I didn't think it was going to happen anyway.
Why didn't you think it was going to happen anyway?
I thought it was just too damn big, too quick, too hard to finance, and in the middle of the cry. I just thought there was no way we could get over the final hurdles. That was an opinion. That wasn't based on anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, remember, Lehman was twice the size of Bear.
Right, right.
And we were a far stronger institution, and more bigger than Barclays.
So what do you think the impacts would have been if there hadn't been an intervention in the case of AIG?
Well, you know, I'll be a parochial for a second. We would have been fine. You know, I mean, it would have hurt us, but it wouldn't have been it would have just been another loss of some sort. We weren't relying on them for a lot of things. And I think that would have had, first of all, I think it had global ramifications. I think some of their insurance, some of the insurance they did and stuff like that and capital provided, a lot of it was around the world. It wasn't just in the U.S. And you really got to ask Hank Paulson, but if you ask me today, I still believe that would have had far bigger global, there would have been a lot of people saying, don't make that our problem. And I really don't know I can't really tell you all the other things. They made a judgment call that they're better off doing, you know, saving it and letting it go down. And I if I had to guess, I would guess they were right.
Do you recall any discussion?
But it goes to show, saving it, the whole world didn't say, and then what Lehman got bought, that the whole world didn't say, ah, great, we're back, everything's okay.
Right.
And the crisis continued.
And that sort of gets to my next question. Do you recall during the weekend any discussions about, you know, AIG coming to the New York Fed on Saturday, changing the calculus on whether or not to provide assistance to Lehman?
I don't remember them being linked at all. I do remember AIG that they said they had a problem and needed immediate assistance. I did not hear anyone link the two, and I was as old and as Hank.
Okay. So, now, following Lehman, it's the following weekend after that, the other two investment banks become bank holding companies, and then the following Thursday, the 25th, I think, is the date that the FDIC puts down WaMu and you folks take over WaMu. Can you walk us through that generally and then tell us what you found in the trunk of WaMu when you took them over?
Right. So we got a call. Remember, the WaMu had a due diligence room set up because they had investment bankers in trying to sell and finance the company. So we had plenty of people looking at the assets of WaMu. Okay. I got a phone call. I'm going to say on a Tuesday or something, Sheila Bear, maybe it was Monday or Friday before, that would you be prepared to bid on WaMu if we did something? I'm not saying we're going to do something. And by the way, it would be an auction. And I said, yes, we would. She said, would you be able to do it where it doesn't cost the United States government money? Actually, it's not the United States government, it's the FDIC, which, by the way, is our money, not the government's money.
Right.
But, and I said, I believe we could. She called me on a Wednesday and said, or Tuesday, we're going to put it up for sale. Here's the, I'm going to have your team come in and tell you the bidding procedures. Our people met with them here. We had 24 hours, something like that. We put in our bid the next day, and she called me up literally the next day and said, it's yours. And I thought there was other bidder, by the way, the whole time. But otherwise, I would have bid a dollar, not $1.8 billion. But we wanted to win, and we thought it would be good for long-term for our company. The real issue, the regulators made a determination that there was a run on the bank. And the run on the bank is probably caused by lack of confidence in the bank, caused by people perceived to have some bad assets and stuff like that. That had nothing to do with us. I don't know. I do know the numbers. I do remember seeing a run that showed they lost $15 billion or $17 billion of deposits in a very short period of time. So obviously the FDIC made a judgment about what their responsibility is, and I think they need a group of people have to come to the determination that they have to do something like that. Our real concern was the assets. And we wrote those assets. And remember, again, this is really important if you want to be fair to everybody in this. There are two different accounting standards. If you have an asset on your balance sheet at par, and you own it, and you originated it, you have to have loan loss reserves that you think represent loan losses or reserves that represent permanent impairment. Okay?
All right.
Let's say you have it $5 or $10 reserves up, so it's on your balance sheet for 95 or 90. That may be perfectly legitimate accounting. When we buy it, the requirement is that we have to put up reserves that represent their lifetime losses. Okay, so that means we have to calculate and estimate losses over multiple years and impairments over multiple years and put up reserves in that. So we would put on our balance sheet at 80. So the fact is, we wrote down their assets the day of purchase by, I'm going to say, $35 or $40 billion to represent the lifetime losses. And we still think within reason, it's a little worse than that, but within reason, that's still a rational assumption.
So what did you find in the trunk when you took them over? What were the, I guess I'm most interested in, the unpleasant surprises?
Well, you said unpleasant. You know, we had gone through all the, you know, the things, and again, people have difference of opinion. We thought the losses were going to be higher in home equity, option arm, subprime, small business, and credit card than they did. We may have different assumptions on the economy, and those could be legitimate differences. They could have been seen through, you know, rose-colored glasses. But the $40 billion is a pretty... We thought the losses were going to be bigger than what they had, and the environment was going to be worse. And the $40 billion, and the real issue, if you ask today, looking back, we were right. And the 40 will be worse than 40. We've already put up another several billion dollars of reserves specifically for the credit impaired part of that portfolio. It was even worse than we thought the day we bought it. But remember, the environment got worse too. The environment hadn't gotten worse, and maybe they would never have gotten worse than that.
In your going back to causes of the financial crisis, in the written statement you sent us for the hearing, and you touched upon this a little one in the beginning of our conversation, but you had mentioned while you were certainly not blaming the regulators, that stronger regulation may have been able to prevent some of the problems that happened, and you wrote, in many instances, stronger regulation may have been able to prevent some of the problems. I want to be clear, I don't blame the regulators. But could you provide some more color on that?
Yeah, I would love your report to deal with this too. I don't blame the regulators for the mistakes of companies, okay? I blame the companies. Mm-hmm. It's their job. It doesn't matter what your regulators say. It's like, you know, you're the parent. You're responsible for your kids, not the teacher. You know, and so I'm being very clear about individual responsibility of the companies. But if you, in your shoes, you should ask the question, if the regulators had done all the right jobs, would we have had all these problems? The answer is no, we would not have. So clearly, they should look at themselves, just like I look at us and say, what are the mistakes we made? What are the mistakes that we made in regulatory? And they were large, okay? Basel II was accepted by the SEC for the five investment banks way before I think they had the ability to really measure Basel II. There was too much leverage allowed in the system. The mortgage business should have been regulated, and you know, some of the regulators had the authority and didn't. Okay, they don't think they were making a huge mistake, but they really didn't say, we don't want to see this anymore. If you look at mortgages around the world, some other countries are doing far better than that. There was too many regulators. There was too much overlap. There was inconsistent regulation. AIG derivatives would be a perfect example of that. So these are things, a lot of the things I listed up front, really, really good regulation would have caught a good portion of it. And I remind people, you don't have to catch 100% of it not to have had this problem. If you had caught, in my opinion, 30 or 40% of it, it never would have gotten this bad. It would have been, you know, more of what I would call a normal financial crisis.
Right.
So, well, you mentioned Basel II. Which, what aspect of Basel II was most important that was implemented, I guess, too early for the banks to handle?
You know,
the investment bank.
Investment banks used to manage their liquidity and capital under other rules, I think of the NASD, called net capital requirements, etc. Basel II allowed them much more leverage, which they used. And you can look at just gross numbers and stuff like that. You know, again, I don't want to point fingers. Basel II was already being used around the world. The OCC and the Fed hadn't allowed J.P. Morgan to use it yet. But you know, it wouldn't have changed anything we did, by the way. So it was inconsistently being applied around the world. But it did allow those banks to compete and leverage up more than they would have had they been under the old rules. Mm-hmm. And I think the old rules would have given them more protection.
So
we're still not under Basel II. we're bypassing, we're right to Basel III.
That's right.
So I wanted to ask you a follow-up question on one of the things you mentioned in your testimony. Eric, I have to confess, we didn't talk about this before, so if this you're not prepared to answer this, I understand. But one of the things you talked about in that written statement was the October 13th, 2008 meeting about TARP and where the banks were asked to or maybe told it's time to take TARP money. And I was hoping you could just walk us through that meeting, if you could.
Yeah, Hank called us all. I think he called us all up and said, "I need you to come down to Washington." It happened to be Columbus Day, I guess, which I didn't want to go. I told him no. He said, "You have to come. It's important. I got all the big banks down there." So we all showed up at 3:00, I think it was, and you know, behind in the room was Tim, Sheila, Tim Geithner, Sheila Bair, John Dugan, who ran the OCC, Hank Paulson, obviously, and Ben Bernanke. And they made a coherent, I thought, and cogent argument about responding to this crisis, which, remember, was getting dramatically worse.
Right.
Okay, and wasn't leading to a run on some of the banks, but it was getting far worse in the marketplace. And they'd already passed TARP, so we knew about TARP. And he said, "Look, I want you all to take capital." They had a calculation of how we were going to all do it, but you know the number, $25 billion for these bunch of people, and 10 for those bunch.
Right.
You will agree to some restrictions. I need you to do this because, and so there's some comp restrictions in there. They talked about the FDIC guarantee program, which would help a lot of banks raise long-term funds. It was not an issue for J.P. Morgan. And it was a pitch that we need to do this for the United States of America, folks. And you may not like it, but this can stop the catastrophe. And some people on the spot said, "I'll take it." Some people were, "I don't want to do it." And I, of course, said, "I got to talk to my board." And everyone agreed to do it. And some out of patriotism and some out of need, maybe. And I don't think all the banks in that room are in the same boat. But we all agreed to do it, and we left by 5:30.
Who were the folks that didn't want to do it?
Wells Fargo was had just raised money and just done a deal and said they didn't need it, but he did it too, though.
Right.
You know, and you know, I was torn. You know, my clearly told my board this is asymmetrically bad for J.P. Morgan because it's leveling a playing field that maybe shouldn't be leveled, but. It's probably, but we certainly won't be better off if some of the other companies fail. Remember, Hank, the other one was, if you nine do it, I can get hundreds of other people to do it and inject huge capital in the system. And that would, you know, stabilize things. And so I thought that his argument actually might work. So how could J.P. Morgan stand in the way of saving the financial system of the United States of America, which obviously would be good for us too? You know, it wasn't saving us directly, but certainly indirectly, it was a huge beneficiary. And, look, I'm sure that people made the same calculation. I know most other people spoke to their boards, and everyone agreed that when your country asked you to do that, obviously they came to the same, somehow they came to the same conclusion, regardless of their initial reaction.
And do you recall any more, you know, any more color, any more specifics on what the coherent and cogent argument from the government on what the what they thought the consequences would be if folks didn't do it?
Oh, so you mean if like eight, and first they said that we need all nine of you to do it, because they wanted kind of a show of strength. They didn't want to isolate that one, some might be stronger than another. They thought they would have another negative short-term effect, even though you could have done it that way, by the way. And they said that it's not just you, we're going to turn around and do this for everybody, or those who qualify, and that's good for you. And however you don't like this thing, and... the only argument, and I would tell you today that if my board said no, I would have told them no. And my guess, I told my board, my guess is they want to talk to you directly, so stay on the line. And that they could not have made, in this country, they could not have made J.P. Morgan take the money. On the other hand, they were all of our regulators. I mean, so they didn't say, you know, all of us are sitting here and we will torture you to death, but I assumed that that would have been the case. And they did say, but by the way, if you don't take it and you need it, it's going to be a lot worse for you at that point in time. And by which I think they didn't even have to say that. We knew that would have been true. Because, you know, this was 5.5% preferred or whatever, and they also said, by the way, you don't know how bad it's going to get. So you may feel like you don't need it now, but in 3 months you may need it. And as it turned out, two of them went back within a very short period of time for another 20, not 20, but including guarantees, talking about hundreds of billions. And so they were right. I thought they were right about that too, by the way. They did not, no one knew how bad it could get. And so, you know, if you're talking about 20% unemployment, you know, that's a hell of a burden for companies to bear. And so those were coherent arguments too. You don't take it now, it's going to get, and it gets worse, you'll be in tough shape. At that point, it won't be so cheap.
Did they talk, other than talking about potential 20% unemployment, did they talk about other concerns they had if the folks didn't agree to do it? You know, economic repercussions?
No, I think I'll just repeat myself. And they didn't mention 20% unemployment, I mentioned that. I would just repeat myself that we have a crisis, we need you to do this thing. We don't know how bad it's going to get. You got to be prepared. But if we do this, we can maybe turn it around in its tracks. And if you don't do it now, it's going to get worse. I would repeat myself over and over. That was basically what they said.
Okay.
And I, you know, Hank did most of the talking, but not all of it. And that FDIC guarantee program was, like I said, I think very important for some. Mm-hmm. Who were unable to raise money in the public markets.
So, I mean, what was your experience? How bad was it for the 3 weeks, I guess it was 3 weeks, 4 weeks, between Lehman weekend and then? What was on your dashboard?
I was thinking. I guess you can go back and get the record about the markets, okay, which I think they were very bad. Mm-hmm. The volatility, the illiquidity, some things couldn't trade at all. I mean, completely locked. Okay, and so the markets were in terrible shape. companies were unable to get funding. I mean, it was pretty bad. You know, J.P. Morgan itself were doing fine, but we had hundreds of clients, you know, who weren't, and we were lending out money, and we were people pulling down revolvers, and you know, your extreme concerns about credit. I think the real concern though was a snowball. Could it snowball down? You know, and the fact is, you'll never know, and I'll never know. But I would tell you that on that day, you damn well had to think it could snowball down, and you had to start preparing for it. So people, you know, a snowball is pretty basic. You know, I was sitting in the same room I'm sitting right now, thinking about how am I going to deal with 20% unemployment? What could I do? And you know, and we could have survived, in my opinion, but it would have been terrible because I would have stopped lending, marketing, investing, comp, and probably laid off 20,000 people. And I would have done it in 3 weeks. You know, so you get companies starting to take actions like that, that's what a Great Depression is. And I think, you know, I still think that, thank God for Hank Paulson. And anyone who says they were testing all that at that point in time, I think they're just not thinking very clearly. You know, one of the things you should put in your report is, you know, markets are like that. They're fickle a little bit, you know, and you know, we can flagellate ourselves all we want, but we should have things in place to deal with that, because that can happen tomorrow. You know, something can happen tomorrow, and all of a sudden people aren't willing to buy commercial paper and do repo and buy corporate bonds and fund, and what will happen? We'll be yelling and screaming at ourselves all over again. But in reality, when the Fed was set up, it was set up with the FDIC insurance so that you reduced the chance of running a bank, and you gave a bank with the Fed window the chance to create cash very quickly with the liquid assets, which are loans. That's the right thing to do. We shouldn't punish ourselves because we did it. You need some of the same structures around other things. You know, that could be money funds, it could be... Otherwise, we're going to be sitting here in the same thing 15 years or 30 years from now, be somebody else, and everybody pointing fingers to Wall Street. But if the system could have that kind of crisis, you know, it's like, and you know, we haven't fixed all that.
So
I think you ameliorate it by higher capital and better liquidity, but you don't eliminate it.
Right, and understanding, you know, and sure, now all the remaining investment banks are now bank holding companies. But their funding models are still, you know, not like a J.P. Morgan's or other commercial banks. They're still, you know, largely short-term funding in the capital markets as opposed to those wonderful sticky deposits.
That's not completely true. That's not completely true because if you go, like, take Lehman at $120 billion of long-term debt, or maybe more than that. So, you know, they may fund certain things short, but if it's the right liquid thing short, that's okay. So you got, and I, some of these banks, you know, we have $240 billion in long-term debt. Some of these investment banks have a lot of long-term debt, unsecured, plus equity, way before they get to secured financing. And that they're really in a very good position with liquidity, like the investment banks were, by the way, before. In the old days, the net capital requirement essentially required a bank to finance normal haircuts, illiquid positions with long-term debt or equity.
Okay.
And the secured markets are used for very, very liquid stuff.
So the word interconnectedness is thrown out a lot, and I can think of a lot of things that it's tied to, but in your mind, what are the most important mechanisms or the most important markets where interconnectedness turned out to be a problem?
Well, again, I don't even know what people mean by it, so I do agree with the concept. One is that, you know, bad assets can happen across a full spectrum, right? So in certain countries, you have to run a Northern Rock, it created a hell of a problem in London. It wasn't even that big a company, so it wasn't just size. I think the financing markets are fairly interconnected. We had to run a lot of them, not one of them. I think people look at financial companies in general have exposure to each other. I think that was always true, by the way, but in some ways always be true, but that's a form of interconnectedness. And some people point to the derivative markets as being causing another level of interconnectedness, so I think that's blown far out of proportion.
Well, I guess when we talked about runs on dealer banks, I mean, the there are different ways where the investment banks were run. One is through by their hedge fund clients, one is by their repo lenders, and another one through the derivatives counterparties. And how do, in the cases of Bear and Lehman, do you have a feeling of how much of those three factors weighed in?
I don't, but I think, so you're saying repo counterparty, derivative counterparty, and what was the third one?
Prime broker.
I really don't, but you could probably reconstruct that for the companies. But I do think it all played in.
I know this is a tough question to answer, but had there not been the large government interventions, could you see this being worse than the Great Depression?
God knows. I couldn't even remotely answer that. I look at that in terms of odds, okay? There's a chance. I don't give that an unbelievable chance. Because I think there are other actions would have taken place immediately. You're assuming that nothing would have... I mean, if unemployment started at 12 or 15%, that nothing would have taken place? No, of course there would have been huge actions taking place at that point. So I give it only a very low chance that ever would have gotten that bad.
Mr. Diamond, I see it's been an hour and a half. That's the time we allotted. I don't think we have anything else, so I just wanted to thank you very much for your time, unless there's anything else you want to tell us.
No, I'm all set, and I look forward to reading you guys' reports.
All right. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Chris, our understanding is that all of the FDIC's interviews are confidential, but in an abundance of caution, we're designating this one as confidential.
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.